Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Josh Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director with Amnesty International USA, who discusses Amnesty's annual report documenting human rights violations in the United States. Alejandro Bendaña, former Nicaraguan ambassador to the United Nations, who assesses the potential for U.S. intervention in this November's Nicaraguan election, as the Bush administration makes clear its intention to defeat Sandinista Party presidential candidate Daniel Ortega. And Father Roy Bourgeois, founder of the School of the Americas Watch, who describes his group's ongoing campaign to close down the U.S. Army's training school, whose graduates include some of the most notorious human rights violators in the Western Hemisphere. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Economist magazine reports that the grueling war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo may be ending. A 10-day trip in May by 12 United Nations ambassadors to the Congo won some major concessions from the warring factions. First, the Congolese government agreed to lift its ban on political parties, and Uganda agreed to pull its troops out of the Congo, and its allied rebel group has agreed to halt further attacks. But the government of Zimbabwe is more cautious. It has only committed to pulling its troops out after the forces from Rwanda and Uganda have already left the Congo. Diplomats had been frustrated by the lack of cooperation from then-President Laurent Kabila in carrying out a 1999 peace accord. The situation changed in January after Kabila was assassinated by his own troops and his son Joseph took the reins of power. Still, there are many tough issues ahead, especially what will happen to the Rwandan militiamen who were implicated in the 1994 genocide in Rwanda and who now fill the ranks of the Congolese army. Their continued presence in Congo's army was a major factor cited by Rwanda and Uganda in invading Congolese territory in 1998. The militiamen are not likely to surrender their weapons anytime soon, as many have been targeted for arrest by the Rwandan War Crimes Tribunal. New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson is an odd choice to emerge as one of the nation's most courageous drug reformers. A two-term Republican and a former star athlete who does not drink alcohol, Johnson has withstood the wrath of anti-drug crusaders who have dictated drug policy for over 30 years. According to the news magazine In These Times, Johnson has lobbied hard to decriminalize marijuana, restoring voting rights for felons, and permitting pharmacies to sell syringes without fear of criminal prosecution. Governor Johnson has established drug courts to deal specifically with the growing number of female drug offenders, where treatment is a part of the sentence for non-violent offenders. Johnson sees addiction as a public health crisis and wants to adopt harm reduction approaches that have succeeded in the Netherlands and Switzerland. While President Bush has nominated John Walters, a hardliner, as his administration's drug czar, reformers can point to pragmatic policy alternatives in states like New Mexico and California, which last fall passed Proposition 36, mandating treatment, not prison, for first and second time drug offenders. Ethan Nadelman of the pro-reform Lindesmith Center asserts, "The alternative approach is to acknowledge that drugs are here to stay. We should focus instead on reducing the death, disease, crime and suffering associated with drugs and with our failed prohibitionist policies." The Nation magazine reports that in the coming months, Congress is set to pass the Just Say No abstinence-only program for sex education in American public schools. In 1996, Congress provided $250 million for school districts to run the Just Say No to Teenage Sex classroom programs as part of the welfare reform package that was signed into law by President Bill Clinton. Welfare reform requires congressional reauthorization in 2002. By accepting abstinence-only funds, public schools are limited to teaching rejection of premarital sex. It teaches young people that only a faithful monogamous relationship in the context of marriage is the acceptable form of human sexuality. Teens also learn that premarital sex can only lead to teenage pregnancies, sexually transmitted diseases, and even death. By definition, the abstinence-only program either ignores gay teens altogether or labels them as deviants. The sex education program leaves out any mention of birth control or safe sex practices, including how to use a condom. Critics, including family planning advocates, say the Just Say No to Sex campaign has backfired. American teenagers are twice as likely as their European counterparts to get pregnant. In Western Europe, sex ed usually starts in elementary school, and condoms and professional counselling are available in most public schools. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.
Each year, Amnesty International publishes a report documenting human rights violations in nations around the globe. The world's largest human rights group is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year, with the warning that economic globalization must be balanced by globalization of human rights. Among the 149 nations profiled this year is the United States, whose human rights record, Amnesty says, continues to fall short of international standards. Criticisms raised against the U.S. include increased use of the death penalty, especially against individuals who are mentally impaired or who committed crimes as minors. Amnesty cites a long list of cases documenting police brutality linked to racial discrimination, torture against prisoners, and the prosecution of children as adults, many serving time in adult prisons under inhumane conditions. Amnesty further criticizes the U.S. for its failure to ratify the accord establishing an international criminal court, the treaty banning landmines, and the Convention on the Rights of the Child. While the U.S. press often highlights Amnesty International's reports criticizing other nations, seldom does the corporate print or electronic media provide in-depth coverage of the group's human rights concerns focused on America itself. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Josh Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director with Amnesty International USA, who summarizes his group's annual report on human rights violations in the United States.
Amnesty is opposed to the death penalty in all circumstances without reservation. But we're particularly concerned that in the United States, for example, it is still legal to execute people who are accused of a crime committed when they were under the age of 18. And there are now more than 70 people on death row across the country who are waiting to be executed, were convicted of crimes that were committed when they, in particular, were 16 or 17 years old. International law makes very clear that the minimum age must be 18. So these are juvenile offenders, and we would like to see that law changed. Secondly, we are appalled that the United States continues to have the possibility of executing mentally retarded people. Now, that is an issue that was just before the Supreme Court, and they vacated the death penalty in a famous case in Texas of Mr. Penry. And the whole issue is now being revisited by the Supreme Court this fall. And I think many of us are hoping that this time the court will rule that the execution of mentally retarded individuals convicted of first-degree murder who would otherwise be subject to the death penalty in those jurisdictions, in those states, would be unconstitutional. And this would be a major statement by the court, and we think a very important reform. Again, we're opposed to the death penalty altogether. But if you're going to have it, you shouldn't be executing mentally retarded people. You shouldn't be executing people who are under the age of 18 at the time of the crime.
Now, as I understand it, the United States is one of just a handful of industrialized nations in the world that still carry out the death penalty.
Yes. You and I tonight would have trouble naming five or six democracies that have the death penalty. And even those that have it, like India and Japan, for example, use it very sparingly. Japan may execute two or three people at the most in any given year. The United States executes 90 or 100 people in a given year or more. We use it far more than any other democracy, and only, to our knowledge at Amnesty International, four countries make up the bulk, almost 80% of all known judicial executions, Congo, China, Saudi Arabia, and the United States. And to be in such company, I think, is rather shameful for the United States, given our political and legal traditions.
Critics of the death penalty often point to the fact that racial disparities enter into those who receive the death penalty and those who don't. Can you comment on the larger issue of racial discrimination in law enforcement in the United States?
This has been widely documented. It's not a question that blacks are more frequently on death row or outweigh their on death row. The percentage of blacks on death row outweighs the general population percentage. That's not the issue. The issue is the identity of the victim, that when whites are murdered, when whites are the victim of violent crime, of murder, The assailant involved, the defendant, is far more likely to face the death penalty, whether they're white or black. But if they're black, they're the most frequent and the most likely category of person to be subject to the death penalty. And that is very easily traced. It's been widely documented, widely confirmed by study after study in many states, both southern states and other states. And it is a very dispiriting part and dismaying dimension to the criminal justice system in the United States, that a white life is valued much more highly than a black life.
Amnesty International has backed treaties such as the International Criminal Court, the Landmines Treaty, and
yes.
the UN Children's Convention.
Convention on the Rights of the Child, yes.
I wondered if you would sort of go through some of Amnesty's problems with the U.S. positions that have been taken either on the part of the executive branch or Congress.
Right. Well, the problem for us is that the U.S. participates in drawing up these conventions, participates in the discussions and having certain demands on the framers and making very, you know, real contributions to framing these conventions. Then finally, when the time comes to ratify them and give them teeth and have them signed in the White House, the U.S. backs off. The fact that when it comes to, for example, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, only Somalia and the United States have not ratified this convention. Somalia does not have a working government, and the U.S. refuses to do it because one of the provisions in this convention forbids the execution of people who are convicted of a crime under the age of 18. It's a direct violation of the Convention on the Rights of the Child. The U.S. can't sign it. It would violate our laws. It would undermine our commitment to execute these people. Well, that's, we feel, a very unreasonable and wrong position on the part of the United States. The same thing is true with the International Criminal Court. This is a major statement on the part of the international community 50 years after Nuremberg to finally create a standing court to deal with war criminals, with political leaders accused of gross violations of human rights and crimes against humanity. This would not be a court subject to frivolous prosecutions, but a very serious attempt to finally bring these perpetrators to justice. And the U.S. is afraid that our soldiers who participate in so many of these peacekeeping missions would be subjected to frivolous prosecutions. We think that's an uncalled-for position, and so we're very disappointed by that. This treaty needs U.S. support. The same is true of the landmines. We are the only major power that's really refusing to go along with the Landmines Convention. And there are many alternatives to using landmines. General Schwarzkopf now supports this treaty. Many other military leaders do in the United States. And it's really, again, a disappointment to us that the U.S. is refusing to go along with this treaty.
That was Josh Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director with Amnesty International USA. Contact Amnesty by calling area code 617-623-0202 or visit their website at www.amnestyusa.org. During the 1980s, the Reagan-Bush administration covertly organized and financed the Contra Army to overthrow Nicaragua's leftist Sandinista government. The Sandinistas had come to power in 1979 after spearheading a popular revolution to oust hated dictator Anastasio Somoza, a longtime U.S. ally. The American-sponsored Contra War claimed the lives of tens of thousands of civilians and was widely condemned by the international community and the world court. In 1990 elections, the U.S.-backed candidate Violeta Chamorro defeated Sandinista President Daniel Ortega, effectively ending the war. President George W. Bush has now appointed some of the architects of the Contra War, also implicated in the resulting Iran-Contra scandal, to prominent positions in his administration. Meanwhile, Nicaraguans are getting ready to vote for a new president November 5th, and public opinion polls show the Sandinistas' Daniel Ortega with a 7-point lead. The White House, fearing that their old nemesis Ortega could win, has made it clear that Nicaraguans will suffer the wrath of the U.S. should they choose to defy Uncle Sam again. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Alejandro Bendaña, former Nicaraguan ambassador to the U.N. during the Sandinista era, who now serves as the president of the Center for International Studies in Managua. Bendaña takes a look at the history of Contra War veterans Otto Reich and John Negroponte, recently appointed by Mr. Bush, and assesses the potential for U.S. intervention in this November's Nicaraguan election.
Well, it's really the worst kind of throwback, and it was shocking not simply to Nicaraguans, but Latin Americans and people in Washington that sort of remember what the black record of these two and other individuals were. Somebody like Wright actually headed what was known as the Office of Public Diplomacy, which was more of a psychological warfare office, which under the Reagan administration actually went and attempted to influence and pinpoint journalists that were critical of Reagan administration policy, trying to sway, unsuccessfully as it turned out, public opinion, and carrying out a series of activities that were, in spirit, if not in letter, in contravention of the law and the use of public money to try to influence foreign policy and perception. And as for, you know, Mr. Negroponte, he was one of the brains behind the Contra War and had the whole series of liaisons with the Contra leaders in Tegucigalpa. He directed the buildup of the Honduran military intelligence, including their counterintelligence, which, according to records now released, were responsible for the deaths and disappearance of dozens of activists. And there's no way that the ambassador in the U.S. in Honduras didn't know at that time. It was a massive buildup of a U.S. presence, all geared to counterinsurgency, which dealt with both El Salvador and Nicaragua, as well as in Honduras. So we have a resurrecting of these feelings. Now, there, times have changed, but when you have a sort of the figure of Ortega, it sort of rings bells. And at the same time, you've got the Reich in particular strongly dependent on the anti-Castro Cuban community in Florida, an administration that is especially beholden to this community. And as most people in Washington interpret, I understand, this is a bone thrown at the Cuban Americans that wanted him in that position. So it's not good news. Now, whether moderates preserve the influence and keep it away from a rabid right-wing course, but particularly with the shifts in Congress, well, that's something to be determined.
The Bush administration, fearing a victory by Ortega and the Sandinistas, recently sent down their number two in the State Department's Office of Hemispheric Affairs, and that was Lino Gutierrez. What was implicit in his message to the moderate parties and right-wing parties who oppose Ortega?
I think they are worried because the alternative to Ortega would be the continuation of the Liberal Party regime, which has shown manifestations of corruption, which even by Latin American or Louisiana standards are extraordinarily offensive and open. So you've got you have a position which the United States really doesn't like either one of the two alternatives that are there on account of the obvious amounts of discontent with the present regime in Nicaragua, which plays to the benefit of the opposition. So, and if there is a search for third forces, this has pretty much been shut out legally. But I do think that when push comes to shove, what the Americans will be pushing for is a unity of the right. You see, if the right unites, there is no way that the Sandinistas can win. So I think the U.S. is pushing for the classic, the same thing it did in 1990 and 1996, the broadest possible anti-Sandinista front.
Dr. Bendaña, is there an implicit threat from the United States that this nation will punish Nicaragua if they elect the Sandinista party again?
It's either the threat or the perception of the threat. I mean, it may be that the Bush administration at the highest level hasn't given 20 seconds of thought to Nicaragua. But many in Nicaragua actually fear, and the U.S. will play on that fear, that there will be a negative reaction by the United States if Ortega wins. Playing up on that, which the ruling government, liberal government, does, is a factor in the electorate's considerations. And it is a very strong one because there are memories of the war, there are memories of the economic embargo, and you've got irresponsible candidates going around saying, well, if Ortega wins, the United States is going to shut off aid, it's going to be a repetition of the embargo, there's going to be military service. And the United States, rather craftedly, at least its embassy, without making the threats, does not disavow the threats, because conceivably, if it were a clean election and Ortega won cleanly, there should be no reason why the United States couldn't accept that. But the fact is that you have a strong ideological component in Washington, which would not accept that, and increasingly openly. The more likely it seems in the polls that Ortega would rise, I think the greater and greater is going to be the degree of American public and covert involvement as we get closer to the November election. And part of that is going to be stitching this undecided force and trying to get it to throw its weight behind the Liberal Party.
That was Dr. Alejandro Bendaña, former Nicaraguan ambassador to the UN, who currently serves as president of the Center for International Studies in Managua. Visit the center's website at www.ceinicaragua.org.ni. For the past several years, thousands of people have gathered each November outside the U.S. Army School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia, to call for the school's closure. Opponents call it the School of Assassins, where thousands of Latin American military leaders have been trained, many of whom commit rape, murder, and other human rights violations when they return to their own countries. Officers from the Colombian Army, with one of the worst human rights records in the hemisphere, comprise half the number of students now enrolled in the school. Last year, more than 10,000 students, veterans, members of religious communities, and others protested outside Fort Benning, several thousand of whom were arrested for engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience. Opponents of the school were also the first to be arrested at last year's Republican National Convention in Philadelphia. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Father Roy Bourgeois, who founded the School of the Americas Watch more than a decade ago, to bring attention to the human rights violations of its graduates. He discusses the pending court cases of protesters and his group's current effort to support congressional legislation that would close the school.
3,500 entered Fort Benning in a solemn funeral procession, and they were arrested. They were trying to keep alive the memory of those killed by graduates of the school. They were using their voices to speak for the voiceless. Well, among the 3,500 who went on to Fort Benning, they indicted 26, and they were brought to trial here in Columbus, Georgia last week. Of the 26, 24 are going to prison, most of them for 6 months. They will all be going to prison next month. We now have a bill in Congress, as many of our listeners have heard. Representative Joseph Moakley died a few days ago. He took the leadership of this issue in Congress and for years has been calling for the closing of the school. And his bill last year came very close to shutting down the school. We have a new bill pending in Congress. It's H.R. 1810. It's the Moakley bill. There are two other Democrats. Jim McGovern from Massachusetts will be taking the leadership in the House now that Representative Moakley is no longer there. And we have three Republicans also as co-sponsors. A simple bill calling for the closing of the new school. It's now being called the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation that went into effect January the 17th. By a close vote in Congress last year, the Pentagon was able to change the name from the School of the Americas to this new name school. But for us, it's still a School of Assassins. It's a new name, but the same shame. So we're not going away. We're going to continue to work on this issue. The movement will continue to grow.
Are you more hopeful of the bill's success now that the Democrats are going to be in control of the Senate?
Well, we're watching that very closely. We see some glimmer of hope here. The House, however, as we know, will still be controlled by the Republicans. However, with the Democrats taking over in the Senate, we really want to get a senator to sponsor a bill to do what Joe Moakley for years had done in the House of Representatives, to lobby senators to get behind this bill.
A group protesting the School of the Americas was arrested at the Republican National Convention last summer in Philadelphia. Then charges were dropped, but were reinstated last month. Do you think these actions will have any impact on others who were also arrested then and whose cases were also dropped?
It's a good sign that they will. We're watching that very closely. They'll be going to trial now in July. It seems that there's a possibility that they want to somehow make an example of them. They, too, are willing to go off to jail, to prison, you know, for the cause, in solidarity with the suffering poor of Latin America, if need be. They will not be silenced. So from all indications, though, they could be using the group from Philadelphia sort of as a test case. It's a little early yet to tell how that's going to work out.
Can you say anything about what impact the school has on the situation in Colombia in terms of people who attend the school and go back to that country?
Yes, the majority of the soldiers attending the school now are arriving from Colombia. Colombia has graduated over 10,000 to date. I was part of a delegation just a few months ago, and others from the SOA Watch went to Colombia to look into this whole issue of Plan Colombia, the $1.3 billion we're pumping into that country. And I can only say that this is a very, very serious issue. We went out to Putumayo, where the spraying has begun, the strong chemical glyphosate produced by Monsanto. That's killing not only the coca plants, the leaves that from which the cocaine will come, but also the food sources for the people, the farmers there. And we met with the indigenous leaders, and they were really, really angry. They were saying that this strong chemical is not only killing the cocoa fields, but it's destroying their rivers, polluting the rivers. It's causing a lot of health problems with their children, respiratory problems, skin rashes. And they said it very clearly, very, very well. They said that Plan Colombia is killing Mother Earth, and it's killing them. And they asked us to do everything that we can do to stop this madness.
That was Father Roy Bourgeois of the School of the Americas Watch. Contact the group by calling area code 202-234-3440 or visit their website at www.soaw.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is celebrating its 10th anniversary with an audio CD featuring interviews from our archive with noted analysts and activists such as Noam Chomsky, Ralph Nader, and Helen Caldicott on important issues and events of the last decade. If you are interested in obtaining this CD or a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines at area code 203-331-9756 or visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie.